You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network. Thursday, we talk transitions, so we're going to transition out of that, and joining me is, again, knocked off the air by a power outage yesterday, is Chris Woodbridge. So, Woody, thanks for coming back on. I apologize for the power issue, but we need to finish our conversation about the April edition of the Gazette. Before we talk about that, though, I want to ask you... No, I'll hold that off. I had an email after we got off the air yesterday, and I want to read it to you.
Okay.
Hey, Mac, I have a pretty blunt question for Colonel Woodbridge. Does he intend to devote space about the online behavior issue in an upcoming edition of the Gazette? It is certainly an issue that needs to be discussed. I like what I've heard relative to your guests the last couple weeks, General Furness and General Kennedy. Both were very blunt in terms of the statements they made about that. I'm looking to see if the Gazette is going to entertain the issue as well. So are you dealing with that, Woodbridge?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, we're... So right now, online on the website, there are two articles that have come in from the field, short articles on the topic, and in the May issue, I'm currently doing a battle drill to free up some space in the May issue of the magazine to dedicate a feature article specifically to this issue and specifically in the vein of the topic that we were talking about yesterday of how this relates to leadership and the potential or the actual leadership crisis that is in some ways creating the environment that while it may not be the sole cause, it doesn't do much to fix the problem, and it may in fact make the problem worse. So again, looking at this from the leader perspective, and the senior leader perspective. So again, I haven't got that article in my hands yet, but I'm expecting it within the next few days, and we're gonna work that into the production for the May issue. But in the meantime, there are two pieces out there on the Gazette page, on the MCA website. They're free content, so anybody can read them and comment on them after the article. Getting a fair number of comments on those pieces. One's by a lieutenant colonel, the other's by a corporal who's actually on embassy duty in Kazakhstan right now, and wrote a very good piece about changing the environment from top to bottom. And the comments have been good. I would say some of them are not good, and we tend to kind of pull those down fairly quickly when the trolls come out, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, no, there's the anonymous nature of the internet leads to issues. I know newspapers that won't publish anything that doesn't have a name and somehow linked to your identity. Because of the kind of behavior that they see, you know, and anybody, and I guess this is one of the issues relative to these kind of comments that, you know, if you want to do that, go someplace else and do it. You might want to attach your name to it. Just saying,
right?
You know,
right.
But that's not.
You know, the interesting. You're right on, and from a print media perspective, you know, there are. There's hundreds of years of experience and law that has been established around the print news business. So yes, naturally newspapers, journals, etc. are very careful about their fact checking, careful about source checking, because there are, again, a couple of centuries worth of legal precedent and lawsuits, and God only knows how much money associated with, past mistakes.
Right.
How long has the internet been around, and how long has social media, as we understand it right now, been around? Internet since early 90s. This type of social media, 5 years maybe, a little longer for some. It's very much new ground, but a lot of those established principles of intellectual property, libel, slander, all of those have yet to kind of catch up with this new world. And frankly, a lot of our leaders at a lot of levels haven't quite caught up with it yet either. So it's a change in, it's a generational change, and because it's related to technology, it's not intuitive to some people. So, quite a challenge for leaders at every level.
Let's see, another email question. Hey Mac, I've enjoyed the conversation. I have a question for Colonel Woodbridge. Does he think, as you stated in parentheses, that general officers ought to be required to have social media accounts?
Interesting. So
I'll lay out my position. That's where the fight is. That's where you need to be. So I don't want to hear. And the commandant said, I don't have a Facebook page. I don't do Facebook. Well, you need to get one then, Bob.
And that's the interesting thing. I agree with you.
Okay.
I think because as a commander, you're going to place yourself on the battlefield where you are going to have the most influence and the most ability to command and control.
Right.
That is a doctrinal axiom, if you will. That's a chestnut from years and years ago. In this cyber battlefield, that may be that decisive point. So I do agree. Yes, our senior leaders need to have social media presence. In a past life, when I was the head of training for Joint Forces Command for higher level headquarters, our combatant commands and service component level headquarters, this was in the 2010-ish time frame, so about 5-7 years ago, 8 years ago coming up. This was the battlefield, and all of the senior commanders were establishing these Facebook and Twitter accounts as the official account of ISAF, CENTCOM commander,
right.
EUCOM commander, NATO, Supreme Commander, Allied Powers Europe. But what you saw more often than not is it became a staff section. So it is not the admiral, the general, him or herself that's actually transmitting over those various communications means. It's somebody on the staff who's kind of monitoring it, and their job is to essentially answer for the commander.
Right, and that's what's gone on now.
Right.
Okay, my point is this: you don't need to publicize it, okay? But you need to be on Facebook to have a working understanding of what it is, how it operates. You need to be on Twitter because that's where your Marines are. And I would dare say probably ought to be on Snapchat as well. So just you have to have a working understanding. You can't walk into that meeting and look at the briefer like they have a tusk shooting out of the center of their forehead. Okay, that's not because that's where every one of your Marines is spending time, every single one of them. And you cannot be absent from that place. And so get after it. And again, they can be your private accounts, but you better have them because you gotta understand how they're communicating and what's real in their world. And that'll help you be a better leader in terms of, you know, discussing problems and outcomes. So, interesting. I'll pass that along. McNamara and Woodbridge.
There you go.
Neller, stand by. Prepare the copy. Let's talk about let's finish up our discussion about the April edition of the Gazette. Let's backtrack a little bit. The theme of the issue is?
So the overall theme are really non-warfighting specific ideas and issues. The majority of the magazine, or a good half of the content, a little more than half of the content, really are not specifically targeted at warfighting issues. We've got a section on legal issues. Two of those articles, as I had mentioned, are coming out of the Council for the Commandant's Office. Some authors up there have written on very specific topics within the category of sexual assault, sexual misconduct response, and prevention. And some, again, this is in the line of effort I call the public information line of effort to get factual information out there in everyone's hands, kind of a little rumor control. In that same line, I've got articles on performance evaluation system, physical fitness, about three different views of our current evolution of functional fitness. The goods, the bads, and other ideas, and then training as well. We had mentioned this during our discussion yesterday. The finite amount of time and resources available for units to conduct training. I've got two different views of that problem. The first is an article entitled "Rocks in the Pack" that looks at the litany of annual and directed training requirements out there, and looks at it as a management problem of that that burden, a time management issue. Another article is entitled "Empowering Leaders with Annual Training," which looks at, hey, these are the requirements. Now, how, as commanders and leaders, do we use the things that we have to do to make a greater impact on the Marines that we lead? So a couple of kind of a point counterpoint there on annual training.
Okay, I can let me just I used to be the OPSO at MEF Headquarters Group. Okay,
mm-hmm.
And for those of you who don't know what that is, MEF Headquarters Group is the regimental command element for the MEF. We call it a group. I'm not, to make the aviators feel good, like they're actually part of the Marine Corps too. So we've tricked them.
Oh, watch that now.
We've tricked them by calling it the MEF Headquarters Group. Anyway, it's a regimental level headquarters for the command element, right? Anyway, underneath them now are five battalions: Intel, Radio Battalion, Law Enforcement Battalion, Anglico, and who am I leaving off? I'm leaving somebody off. Anyway, those are the major players in it.
Yeah, the combatant, right?
Ninth Crime. And so there was no editorial comment attached to that either. It's a huge battalion, okay? And here's the deal. Everything the MEF does, those guys go with it. Everything. You got to communicate, right? You got to have a slice of intel. You got to know what's going on. And you got to take Radio Battalion with you, too, because it's good to know what they're talking about and thinking about and then whatever. And so the op tempo is crazy. And the Marine Corps, we never say no to anybody, right?
If we do windows.
Yeah, if you're the Siberian, right, stand up Marine Corps on the down low covert, and you want us to train you, we're probably going to do it. And so the op tempo is crazy. So when annual training comes around, it's like, all right, give me everything we have to do. All right, sir, it's these nine classes we have to give. Okay, get the gym. On, let's see, the first 2 days back after the new year, and send out the memo, have the list, and we'll knock it out in 2 days. And you can come on either day, it doesn't matter, but you got to be there for the whole day, blah, 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 blah. And that's how we service annual training, because of the op tempo of the force. And I know people say, well, that's not the way you're supposed to do it. there's so much of that, you know. And, sir, I don't need to it's...
Well, one of the, I think one of the points, actually, that both authors have kind of made, it recognizes those sorts of tensions, those sorts of challenges for finding the time in a very challenging schedule and an op-tempo environment. But an awful lot of annual training has, I'll use the term, devolved into online training. MarineNet,
right.
Do the class, click, 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 print the certificate,
right.
Give it to the training NCO,
right.
And you're done.
You're done.
Both authors are, you know, in whatever form, whether it's one over, you know, 1,000 in the gym, or, you know, one on one, one on two, sitting on packs or sitting on foot lockers, is getting people involved back in that process.
Because I'll tell you, we don't like to talk about this in public, but you make it go away. Hey, can we do it online? Well, we'll check into it. Can we kick it to MCI? Because if we can kick it to MCI, then, you know, when I have some downtime, I'll just tell them, hey, get this done. And then it's done. I just took it off my plate, and it's going to be accounted for on somebody else's time. Love that stuff. Can we do more of it? Because it makes it go away.
Right.
So,
and it also,
I don't know if that's
also,
the appropriate view of it, because there's some things that we've done that to, much to our detriment, that they need to involve people. And maybe you can do that with fishing and with ComSec and how to do your screensaver and making sure that, you know, you understand that loose lips do in fact sink ships and all of that. Maybe some of that is appropriate there, but there's certainly other issues that I think will be very interesting to read that don't belong there.
So, and you know, you make a there is a very strong piece of connective tissue between what we were talking about earlier in this. The danger is that the solution to social media behavior, online behavior, becomes another set of classes. And that when the light shifts elsewhere, that set of classes becomes an online annual requirement and now loses any real impact on actually fixing the problem, becomes essentially window dressing.
Right.
You know, this, if you've been around a while, as you and I both have, you've seen this happen a number of times. It's happened, back in the 80s, it happened with, counterterrorism, anti-terrorism. It happened, in the early 90s after Tailhook with sexual harassment and, sexual misconduct. It happened again after 2001 with force protection, counterterrorism, etc. After WikiLeaks, it happened with loose lips shit. So there's a tremendous reactive,
component,
reflexive,
right,
reaction there. That is the trap that we can fall into with the current crisis in leadership.
All right, let me read you an email. Hey Mac. I'm listening for the first time today, and I'm actually pretty excited to have listened because I found maybe a path to a job when I get out with Turner Construction, and in parentheses, very cool. And now I'm learning that you geniuses are just figuring out that we at Ninth.com go everywhere in the world and support everything that happens. Hello, these annual training requirements, I don't have time for them. And I never did as a staff sergeant. Until the Marine Corps can do something about our operational tempo, all of this stuff is just sidebar stuff. Get this done because you're going to CACS. And he writes, I use that term because I know you old dudes understand it. You're going to CACS in a week.
Ouch.
Get that done because this just stood up. And then in parentheses, a requirement for some kind of mobile training team. We respond to all of that. Until a lieutenant general at the MEF level can say no and look at us with some feel for our op tempo, the rest of this stuff is getting no attention. We simply don't have time. How about that, Woody?
That is a clear indictment, and You know, if 9th Com is having that problem, I guarantee you all the other Com battalions are as well.
Right.
You know, it's a pretty clear reality, and a lot of us have seen this. The you know, the higher demand, lower population, lower density MOSs get road hard, put away wet, and are still expected to do all those other tasks, those annual requirements that we lay on the force as a whole. I think the more we automate this, the more we put it online, kick it to MarineNet or MCI, the better the chances that two things are going to happen. It's not going to get done, period. It's just going to stop making sense to Marines like the staff sergeant that was writing.
Right.
To Marines like the staff sergeant that, you know, all right, in the midst of everything else, I've now got to, you know, break platoons out, break, you know, wiring parties, strapping parties out to go and sit behind a MarineNet terminal and do these classes. And the Marines are just going to click through and do whatever they can to shortcut that process, which loses all training value at that point. In fact, I think it's got a negative training value because it, in some ways, confirms the belief that we are as screwed up as people think sometimes.
Well, again, I think the point's well made. It's not like they don't have enough to do out there.
That's it.
You know, they're going all the time, and then it's like, oh, yes, and this is important, and this is important. One of the first things that, you know, one of the things that we've embraced in maneuver warfare is give me a focus of effort. What is important to you? Well, we all know it's operating, deploying. Okay, what about all this other stuff? Where does it fit? And I guess as commanding officers, they have to define it for us. And if you tell us that everything's important, okay, I know what my fitness report gets written on. And it's not if
exactly.
we do these bullshit classes. It's if my guys are ready to go. Is if my unit's ready to go. And so, again, not everything can be important, but it's,
right.
It sounds like it is.
Well, you know, and again, when you digitize or automate it, then commanders often lose the ability to apply judgment. You know, when something is mandated from an extraordinarily high echelon of command, MEF, MAR-4 and above, and automated, which means the accountability is automated, then commanders lose the ability to apply their judgment. Case in point, if you look at something as mundane as the mandated tobacco cessation annual class requirement for quitting smoking, quitting dipping. Okay, so for the staff sergeant who's been in the Marine Corps, two enlistments and does not smoke and does not use smokeless tobacco, why does that Marine need to take the class every year? As a commander, I can look at that and say, no, he doesn't.
Right.
And you can apply that lens to an awful lot of the requirements that we get. But as the former G3 of Training and Education Command, I will also point out that in many cases, these requirements are mandated by echelons of command beyond the Marine Corps, meaning Department of the Navy and Department of Defense. And we are graded as a service annually on our percentage of completion. Case in point there is an annual training requirement, a class on countering trafficking in persons. So the anti-human trafficking, anti-prostitution, sex trafficking classes. Those are mandated by the Department of Defense. The services and the service departments get graded every year on percentage of completion. And it's gross math. It's how many people do you have, how many of them completed the class, and how up to date is the database of that number. And you get caught in that world, it seems to be all judgment and reason goes out the door.
All right. Give me a couple more things I want to look for in the April edition.
Okay, one very important article. The title of the article is Argmu Employment Methods. It's in our MACDAF operations section. The author's Lieutenant Colonel Paul Brickley, who's up at PPNO on the expeditionary side, the POE code up at PPNO. And so this article is important in that it, again, in a current MACDAF ops and to a degree in a public information effort, essentially lays out what the new normal looks like, not just for the exceptions, but for the rule of our expeditionary forces, our amphibious ready group, and MEW teams that are deploying worldwide. This is not just Westpac, CENTCOM. This is not just MED, CENTCOM, AFRICOM, 31st MEW. This is all of them, and the definitions and explanations of their routine for every deployment, command and control environment and operational environment, that command and control environment supports. So it really cracks open and gives the, ground truth, definitions and explanations of, split ARG ops, distributed operations, aggregated and disaggregated operations, both at sea and ashore, and how that command, those command and control arrangements are actually structured. So in terms of explaining what is the norm now, the rule, not the exception, exceptional piece of work there. So again, very, very important, I think, for everyone who considers themselves a MACDAF Marine, whether they're on a MEW right now or getting ready to go to one, or did one 10 years ago and think that they know what it means, this is an education, so important.
All right, give me one more.
Last one is, I really got a, so we got a section on training technology. Title of the article is Decision Room. And what this really is a description of what one infantry battalion at Camp Lejeune has done to develop at the battalion level a capability for training small unit leaders in decision making, meaning tactical decision making. And the important part here is creating an environment. Both a command climate and a physical environment, i.e. stuff and tools, to support junior leaders, getting the reps at tactical decision making. And so the Commandant and others have talked about the importance of, multiple reps and sets to build mastery, of certain skills. Tactical decision making, company down to team level, actual fighting your unit and making combat tactical decisions for that unit, requires repetition. And the more repetition, the more hours spent at that, the better. And, you know, you've probably heard the yardstick from, Malcolm Gladwell's book about the 1,000-hour rule. Of, you know, it takes about 1,000 hours to, 10,000 hours to, build mastery in any given task. This was an effort by that battalion, and we're talking about a 2nd Battalion, 6th Marines. Their CO is a Lieutenant Colonel named Marcus Mates, who's actually out your way right now. He's in Yuma supporting a WTI with the battalion. But, what they did is, really exploit every possible resource available. They went to the Camp Lejeune simulation center, went to the training support center at Camp Lejeune, found what systems, training systems and simulations were not getting used, vacuumed them all up, signed them out, vacuumed them up. That's everything from ITEST, the new version of Miles Gear, to the combat decision range. They went to Dermo and picked up as many used laptops as they could get hold of. They reached out to us here at the association for access to the Gazette's TDG archives. They've been working through Training Command with the Office of Naval Research to get hold of some developmental programs that support doing TDGs in an interactive environment. And they laced all this stuff together not on a range, not out in a training area, but right in the barracks, right in the common rooms of the barracks, so Marines can use it 24/7, any day of the week, and can essentially fight each other, can play games against each other as individuals or as groups, squads, teams, platoons, as an adjunct to more formal training, both live and the simulation-supported training for companies and platoons. So it's really exceptional. I've been down there to see it myself.
Oh, really?
Yep, absolutely. The good news about this is really probably the best news is that the commandant and General Walters, the assistant commandant, have also seen this. General Walters went down there and has put together a rapid capability office to look at creating a capability like this for multiple battalions in the Marine Corps. Use some funding available as needed to I'll call it cross-pollinate this capability across all infantry battalions, and that's a huge step in the right direction. Building a real capability for free play, force on force, simulated decision making exercises, and that's how Marines get the reps in tactical decision making. It's really pretty exciting stuff. We've had actually a series of articles, both online and in the magazine, that touch on different parts of this.
I started teaching a decision-making class at the basic school, at IOC, really, and then migrated back to the basic school in 1990, 1991 maybe. And I've always, I think you'll find this funny. I go back, I'm a son of a Major League Baseball manager. So sports very much colored how I learned about making decisions and being involved in a dynamic event, and baseball in particular, chief among them. I watched my dad every night with a lineup card strategize against somebody else. Sometimes it was against Sparky Anderson and the Big Red Machine. In that case, you were the prey and they were the hunter, right? They dictated the matchups, and you did your best to fight them. Other times... and it didn't happen very often with the Padres, but sometimes he had the upper hand, and it was interesting to watch that. So I watched that tactical game. Additionally, I watched young people either, be able to navigate or not. So I'm training my own platoon, and I'm watching, and I watch his behavior. I go back to teach at the basic school, and I'm thinking, why do they have such a hard time figuring out how to make decisions? What is it? And so I think it's one of the most interesting things that you can study in the Marine Corps. And I would encourage anybody listening to if you haven't, and I know everybody thinks they have, but I'll tell you what, you really haven't. And I would tell you this. The first thing you should read is by Russell Solfe, and Doctor Type. And he wrote something called The Bias for Action. And in that, there are some quotes that you will read from an organization, the 7th Panzer Division, led by Erwin Rommel, about how they prepared for combat and what they tolerated in training because they knew the reality of where they were going. And so I would tell you that and I'm trying to find my decision making PowerPoint so I can read the exact quote. Give me one second. And it essentially is this. The decision on the part of the 7th Panzer Division to allow more latitude in training on the part of junior officers was not an excuse for slipshod performance. It was a reality that in combat, in friction, in the world of uncertainty, that poor decisions would be made. Those poor decisions could be overcome by a subsequent better decision as long as one was inculcated into the habit of making decisions. The dissection, the beating to death of a bad decision was never in their lexicon. Overcome it by another good decision. That's the way the 7th Panzer Division went to war. When you look at their success in France and Russia, you can see an organization that truly had a bias for action. And so to me, that's really one of the ways we screw people up is the way we do the whole thing. Okay, you get around the sand table. All right, you guys are going to give me a solution. You two guys are going to stay with me. You're going to be the bad guys. All right, then we go roll into the sand table. The bad guys have kind of there have their little plan. All right, McNamara, give me a solution. So I read my mission and my execution paragraphs of my order. And everybody, okay, questions? What if this? What if this? What if this? And the only conclusion that can be drawn from that is, why would I ever put my dumbass hand up again? Okay, all I did was I got second guessed to death, right? And that's not the battlefield.
Yeah, it's always easier to second guess.
Right.
It's always easier to write a paper than it is to write one.
Yeah. What if this? What if this? Well, that's not the real world. The enemy has to take one course of action, just like you do. And then really, so I discovered this teaching in classroom 4 at the basic school. All right, you guys are going to be the bad guys. You have a course of action. Okay, give your, Woodbridge, come here. Give your estimate of the situation, all right, and then give your mission and execution paragraphs. Now, you guys are all squad leaders. Any questions about, based on his estimate of the situation and his execution, any questions about that? And if what if comes out of your mouth, okay, all right, everybody's going to pay. No what ifs. You heard his estimate. You can ask questions about his estimate, about did he account for this, did he account for this. But based on the estimate, it doesn't make sense. Well, yeah. Okay, well, now we're going to execute. And so I used to have a tack war die, that 10-sided die, and I used to have a coin. And so I'd say, okay, now we're on the table. Well, the bad guys had to be someplace. You know, they had to be someplace. And so they'd start moving, and then, like, the bad guys would say, hey, sir, we want to shoot now. All right, heads or tails? Everybody looks around like, what's going on? And look at the lieutenant, the platoon commander. Heads or tails? Heads. Tails. You just had somebody step in a hole and break his leg. He's got an open fracture. What do you do?
Right. It takes in the elements of chance and uncertainty.
I can't. It's an open fracture. I can't take him with me. I got to medevac him. All right, call him a medevac. And they look at you like, that was 3 weeks ago, sir. Stick your finger in your ear, call in the medevac, or have somebody do it, and you keep running the platoon. Okay. And he points to the smartest guy in the right standing there. Hey, Murphy, you call in the medevac. Murphy's like, what? And so Murphy calling in. Now, what are you doing, Lieutenant? We're going to continue to move. Who's staying? That squad's staying. Okay. So and then now you're starting to see them exercise the muscles in the gym. Now the bad guy. Now the bad guys say, okay, on the 10 side of dice. Okay, and then we'd have a discussion. Bad guy's going to shoot. They've been watching you. The range is 700 meters. They're shooting a machine gun. It's not on a T&E. What are the odds? First round's impact. Not on a T&E. That's bad. That is bad. All right. So it's going to be employed out of the bipod. Bipod's okay. 50-50. All right. Everybody okay with that? Yeah. Let's call it 50-50. All right, so 0 to 5, all right, is you hit, right? Roll the dice. Tackle dice, 7. Uh-oh, you missed. Okay, now put a little poofy where we just saw a signature. Poof, right there. And so you begin to build this thing, and guess what? They're all in. And because on any given day, the good guys might actually win. Which is tremendously exciting. And then guess what? Then they're talking shit back and forth. And so now it becomes a competition. And whenever you make Marines compete, what happens? They get all in. It's a beautiful thing. But the way we teach it is so debilitating sometimes. And so I remember doing it, and they beat my ass one day. And they were so fired up. They're high-fiving as they're walking out of classroom 4. They're like, hey, sir, next time we get our group. It's 2nd Squad, Echo Company, 3rd Platoon. I'm like, get the hell out of here. But what happened was their creative mental energy as professionals got involved in their craft.
You're spot on.
And all you had to do was get out of the way at that point.
Yeah, and that is in so many ways exactly what I'm seeing going on and what's been going on with 2-6 and now with more and more battalions, you know, taking what they've, you know, the groundwork that they've developed, and now with some Marine Corps support to create an environment where they can put it together themselves. And what I found most impressive about it is, I mean, this, we're talking about the common rooms in you know, barracks at Camp Lejeune.
Right.
You know, this is not a by definition a high tech environment.
Right.
And Marines have networked these computers together, and the activities that you're describing, the estimate of the situation, issuing a frag order, giving guidance while in contact, adjusting and making decisions based on chance and on enemy action, all those same activities are going on. What they've done is, as I said, vacuumed up every piece of available technology that can be used as a tool to support that and to make it faster and more interactive. And, you know, Marines, again, individual Marines, after hours on a weekend, fighting each other as teams, as squads, and again, getting that gym time, those reps and sets,
right,
is the most important thing. You know, we as a service, have always, and particularly for the last 15 years, again, from some TCOM time here, we've invested a lot of money in creating environments for Marines to develop technical and procedural skills, very complex techniques and procedures, combined arms, live fire, fire and maneuver, coordination of all supporting arms, command and control. Those are fundamentally technical and procedural skills. Those are only effective when they are applied in the right situation, and that is a decision-making skill. It's a higher level, more cognitive skill. What this battalion, again, on their own, with people just kind of getting out of their way, has developed is a capability for doing that training, and doing it with such high volume that you actually have the time. Here's the other piece to it. When you talk about getting the, the wire brushing, critique that, makes you never want to, be the poor guy who's got to answer the question or provide the solution again. Sometimes that's driven by the fact that you only get to do it once or twice.
Right.
And only a few guys are going to get to actually be in the hot seat. Well, this isn't just a case of, every Marine in the platoon, doing it one time. Every Marine in the platoon's doing it day in, day out, over and over again, as they're when they're not in the field, when they're not doing some other type of training, they can and are doing this training. It's pretty impressive. I think it's very much a step in the right direction towards building that small unit tactical decision maker, and ultimately they're the ones who win a lot of fights.
And again, it's not infantry centric. You can do these decision exercises with convoys. You can do it with creating comm sites and the different problems that come up.
Exactly.
And all the different things. But what it's really designed to do, and that's why Solfi's Bias for Action is so, I think, such a critical thing to read, is that, look, we can all write orders, okay? But we all know what wins is execution. It doesn't mean you should write a piece of crap order, because you shouldn't. It's got to be your best effort. But that order has to be given in time so that your subordinate can receive it, can rehearse, and do all those things. We tend not to do that, and we screw them up. And so understanding this process, and then on the execution piece of it, the ability to make a decision, to articulate that decision to subordinates, sometimes it's in a frag order, sometimes it's yelling, but to get out of the business of getting a wedge and follow me, all right, that happens, right, too often. That's what you're striving for, getting people to understand how decisions are made, and then, most of all, getting, I think, subordinates mindful of a concept called, and I created this term, all right, years ago, coordinated initiative. Initiative on the battlefield will get you killed. it will get you killed way more often than it will get you a Medal of Honor. Okay? And so if it's important enough for you to deviate from the plan, it's important enough for us to go with you. And you got to take us with you. So when you just make that decision, the first thing you need to do is coordinate it, because old Lieutenant Colonel Woodbridge in the S3 might be saying, hey, Mac, great idea. We have Cobras en route to take care of that. Keep pressing. Right? And that's how you don't fritter away your combat power. So this so the way we teach initiative gets worked on in that gymnasium. Hey, great decision. You're going to go after it. What's the first thing you got to do? I got to coordinate it with. Why? Because the machine gun section doesn't know you're there. And guess what? They see little heads popping up in a place that they're not supposed to be popping up. That's what might happen. They might light your shit up. And so it's all that rich stuff that is real lessons from the battlefield. And one other thing is that, and the other thing is that when you begin to do these things, you'll have guys standing around that won't, sometimes they participate, sometimes they don't. And sometimes they're staff NCOs. And then they'll come up to you afterwards and say, hey, sir, I went through something as a comm relay site when we got into a fight we never thought we'd get into. Would it be okay if I did something with that? And then you get these collaborations of real world experience where staff NCOs can sit and hold court about, yeah, well, this is what we did. Yeah, I didn't know that. And you see young Marines sitting there at their knee, kind of soaking all this in and saying, wow, you know, when Lee tells Longstreet and McClaws to take off around the Union left flank at Gettysburg, they've already extended their flank and his plan's already screwed before they even step off because the intel it was based on was wrong.
Right.
Wow. You know, in those lessons. So.
Anyway. Well, and that is, some of that is the source of some of the best tactical decision games,
right.
that are the foundation for those discussions.
Right.
Part of this effort is also to start folding that material back into the Gazette so that we can share it to a much wider audience.
There's a lesson that I got out of Douglas Southall Freeman's papers. It's a letter from the engineer who did the reconnaissance of Little Round Top on the morning of the second day at Gettysburg. He's a captain by the name of Johnston, and it's all written in the first person. He writes to McClaws, I think it's after Lee's death, and they're still fighting about Gettysburg, whose fault it was and things like that. But he says, you know, I was sleeping by the fire near the seminary when General Lee came and woke me up at about 3 a.m, which was his custom. Over the fire, he took his map and he showed me yonder small hill and told me to ride down the ridgeline. Well, what he doesn't see is Gamble's brigade is down in Plum Run, and he doesn't see it. And so he goes and comes back, and he gives Lee a report that is not accurate. But you're reading in the first person, you know, history coming alive for you. Just awesome. Just awesome stuff. And then you're sitting there at Gettysburg thinking, Lee's making his plan, and it's I won't say doomed from the start, because even as badly as the situation had changed in front of him, you know, they come pretty close on Little Round Top of actually getting it done. And that was because of the on-the-spot decision-making of Longstreet, McClaws, Hood, as they extend the right flank continually. And were it not for Governor Warren going up on that hill and seeing them and then getting more Union troops in that direction, the Union would have had their left flank rolled up, even though they didn't have it right when they started. So. Anyway, as you can tell, I'm moderately interested in
this. Yes. Well, I encourage you to read that article in the April issue, and online there are additional articles about the things that 2-6 has been doing. I'm a firm believer if it's good for one infantry battalion, it's probably good for all of them, and probably good for a lot of those other non-infantry units as well.
Got it. All right. Woody, certainly appreciate the visit. And anytime you want to talk decision making, you know who to call.
Absolutely.
Indeed. All right. No, in fact, I'll give you one more little nugget. I took, at IOC, we used to do a toot at Gettysburg. And I asked Major John Allen at the time, I said, would you care if we just went up there and looked at four decisions instead of doing a two? And he said no. And I said, I'll create at every stop parts, and lieutenants can be assigned, and there'll be a bio of whoever is the primary players, and lieutenants will play those parts, and they'll stand up, and they'll talk about who I am, what campaigns I've been in, and then they'll kind of give a narrative of, I come down this road, and here's what I see. And then we can do a kind of a discussion about the decision. And it was so cool because somebody said, yeah, well, why not this? And the lieutenant would look and say, I don't know that. And they were like, oh, that's not good. And you're sitting there on Gettysburg, and you're reading these first-person accounts, and it's kind of seeping out of the grass, and it was awesome. I loved it. And just because they got to see friction and uncertainty manifest itself on ground they were on, the confusion that resulted, and what won and what lost, what wins on the first day is guys like John Reynolds, guys like John Buford, not hesitating, complete professionals in terms of knowing their craft and knowing how to select terrain, knowing how to communicate, knowing how to coordinate with adjacent units. Gettysburg's really the first day, I think the first battle, where the best commanders are in charge of the Union Army, and every one of them hits it on the screws. And it's no... But it's so wonderful to go there because the battlefield's still largely intact. So much written about it that you can put something like that together. But it makes decision making alive. They feel that uncertainty, that confusion, and then what won the day was decisive leader with their head in the game, making quality decisions, and then evolving those once contact was made. So
it's funny you should mention that, because in the April issue, you've also did something a little unique. There are two book reviews. They're not counterpoint or contradictory. They're two complementary book reviews by two different reviewers of the same book. The book is entitled A Savage War. It is a comprehensive military history of the Civil War by Dr. Williamson Murray, professor emeritus of history at The Ohio State University.
Oh, he's big time.
He is Wick Murray. He goes by Wick. Wick is exceptional historian and an exceptional educator of military history. Co-authored with Wayne Weishang She, a Chinese author, looking at a truly comprehensive view of the Civil War. These review essays are on point, good reviews explaining why any Marine should read this book. They both approach it from kind of different perspectives, but if I think right up there with Battle Cry of Freedom, this is going to become one of the canon, if you will, of definitive histories of the Civil War.
Wow! All right. Well, we'll look for it. Woody, thanks for the visit. Appreciate it.
You bet, Mac. Thanks for having me, and look forward to next time.
All right, bud. Thank you.
All right. Out here.
That is Chris Woodbridge, the editor and publisher of the Marine Corps Gazette.